This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
Instead of, you know, that's not normal, guys. There's something wrong with us when we do that. So we do have the right to be right. As I said, the law of averages suggests that you'll be right 50% of the time. If you're apologizing most of the time, 50% of your apologies are lies. So the next time, you know, we're such groupthink people. You know, one of the interesting things is the discussion that goes on. By the way, I believe in hell. I agree with Spurgeon, who says whenever you preach hell, make sure you got tears in your eyes. And I think that's true. I believe there's eternal, probably conscious punishment. And it's a very scary kind of thing. But one of the interesting things is that many English evangelicals believe in annihilationism. They believe there's punishment commensurate with sin, but eventually the soul or whatever it is eventually annihilated. Seventh-day Adventist, I think, believe that. And I think a number of the other groups believe that. George Wenham, you remember John Stott has recently gotten into a lot of trouble with J.I. Packer over this particular issue. You know, sometimes we American evangelicals, rather than saying we believe in a conscious, eternal conscious punishment, we say we believe in eternal conscious punishment and we're glad. And we communicate that to people. The English go in a different, a lot of the English evangelicals have gone in the other direction. And George Wenham, who is an intellectual in England, wrote a very good book called The Goodness of God. And in that, he had a chapter in which he didn't take a stand on annihilationism, but he had to be so careful what he said. But he said the reason that the church has accepted the doctrine of eternal conscious punishment is not because it's necessarily taught in Scripture, but because everybody is afraid to say that there might be a point biblically to the other side of that. And I thought, oh, come on, man, don't be. You know, who am I to say that to Wenham? But I felt that way. And then 4 or 5 years later, after The Goodness of God had been published, Stott comes out and in an interview says he's an annihilationist. Man, you ain't never seen the church. Speaking engagements were canceled all over the world. People would no longer read his books. The book sales went down. And poor Stott is not trying to be unbiblical. And I disagree with him at that point. But where have we gotten to in the church when we can't discuss those things? I mean, something's really bad. When if you tell me, I believe in eternal conscious punishment, and if I had doubts in that, I'm not going to soften it because I could be wrong, and you know that's a pretty scary eternal implication thing. But if you came to me and you said you believed in annihilationism, I'm not going to then rule you out of the kingdom and not listen. But we're into this groupthink. You'd be surprised if you, as a leader, will give people the permission to say what they think, what they will think, and what they will say. And it'll be really healthy in the church. So the manifestation of that is this thing that we have as Christians that we really don't think we have the right to be right. Check it out. You'll find 70% of your friends, I'm talking about Christian friends, if you'll contradict them, they'll back off and at least to your face change their views. Isn't that sad? That's wrong. It's just plain wrong. So on the authority of God's word, I give you the right to be right. Thirdly, you not only have the right to be human and the right to be right, you have the right to be wrong. Acts 10:13-15, Peter, a Jew, had nothing to do with the Gentiles, but God, you remember, gives him this vision, a sheet comes down and all, and that lobster, man, he could have had a lobster dinner if he just shut up. Boiled them and gotten some potatoes, man, it'd been great. But all the unclean foods came down on the sheet, and you remember, and the voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean. That's not a cool statement. Don't say not so and Lord in the same sentence, man. Say not so, that's cool. Say Lord, that's cool. But don't say them both together. They shouldn't be said. For I have never eaten anything common or unclean. And a voice spoke to him again the second time, what God has cleansed, you must not call common. Well, if it had been the voice of the church, we would have said, you're wrong, wrong, wrong. I don't want you to be going to these Gentiles anymore because you're not fit. If the law of averages suggests that you'll be right 50% of the time, the law of averages suggests you'll be wrong 50% of the time. If it's just common guesswork, flipping a coin, you're going to be wrong some. I love the physics professor who said to his class after 4 years of people getting an undergraduate degree and taking many of his courses, I want you to know that 50% of what I taught you was wrong. I just don't know which 50%. Let me tell you something. Wouldn't it be refreshing if a preacher said that from the pulpit? Or one time, if you're aware of 1 Peter, in 1 Peter 3 and also in 1 Peter 4, there's a statement that really gives people fits. In 1 Peter 3, Peter says that Jesus goes and preaches to the people who had died before in the time of Noah, preaches to the ones in prison. Now, that's hard enough to do a proper exegesis on and to expound it properly from the pulpit. But God, in his great sense of humor, and I believe that's what it is, in the 4th chapter of 1 Peter, then repeats it again. He doesn't repeat it the same way, but he says, that's why the gospel was preached even to the dead. And so in the pulpit, I said, and we were sending out thousands of tapes, so I said, I was teaching 1 Peter, and I said, I know what that seems to say, but I don't think it's saying that. And then I said, but I'm not sure exactly what it is saying, so I'm going on the next verse. I got letters from all over the country. You know, everybody wanted to straighten me out and wanted to tell me a proper understanding of that verse. Now, I believe, by the way, that if your theology is proper, and this is one of the dangers of Reformed theology, is that we think everything's got to fit in the suitcase, and it doesn't. You know, if we're worshiping a sovereign God as awesome as we say he is, and everything fits in your suitcase, then it ain't God. It's stuff that fits in your suitcase. God's big. He's a lot bigger than we think he is, and a lot bigger than we can think he is. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways. Thus saith the Lord, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. I remember that sometimes. Somebody brought the... I did a talk show last week, a call-in thing out of Buffalo in preparation for our doing our thing there. And the guy's name is Neil. They always have to kind of separate themselves from me when they bring me on. Our guest is Steve Brown. I know you won't agree with everything he says, but we know he loves God, so we're going to listen. It's always that addendum that says, I ain't associating with you, man. I need this job. And so Neil had done that. And then somebody had called up and asked me about, what was I talking about? My mind went off to Buffalo, and I was thinking, man, I don't, what? Right to be wrong. Oh, shoot.
Sex.
No. You got a problem. You know that. And I don't think you ought to do that to your congregation, man. It's going to reveal stuff you don't want revealed. Oh, shoot. And it was such a good illustration. And then I got to thinking I didn't want to go to Buffalo. And then I thought I had to mow my yard. And then I was going off in all kinds of things. If it comes back to me. But you have the right to be wrong. You have the right to say, I don't know. I just don't know. Or to teach it, this is what I think, but I may change this tomorrow. And I think there is a refreshing quality about doing that, if you do it, that gives people, you know, you are not in the pulpit because you're so smart or because you know more than everybody. You're in the pulpit because God put you there. And you got to remember that you worship a sovereign God who doesn't fit in the suitcase. And that means that a significant portion of the time you're going to be wrong. I just thought of the illustration I was going to tell you. This lady called up. And she said, you know what I really appreciated? And then she told me something that I say often, but most of the time get criticized. I say I have this recurring dream. When I get to heaven, God stands and welcomes all of his covenant people from all generations and every nation and every race. And he welcomes them. And then he says, I got some bad news and I got some good news for you. And somebody way in the back says, tell us the bad news first. That's a Calvinist. And God says, bad news is you're all wrong. And a lot of you were really wrong. And then he smiles and he says, but the good news is I've talked to my son about you. And he says, you're okay. So welcome home. That drives people crazy. Just that story. In fact, I've gotten so I tell it because I know it's going to irritate some people that I want to irritate. But it's true. You know, we just don't have a corner on God. God doesn't fit into our... You know, there's an event. I think it's young Roberts at Oral Roberts University. What's his name?
Richard.
I saw him one time praying for somebody with his hand on his head saying, yes, Lord, Now, I don't know, but I don't think he was... I don't think God was doing from his mouth to his ear. I just don't believe that happened. And as soon as I say that, God reminds me of some stupid thing that I did. But it's okay, because I have the right. I have the right to be wrong. And if you're going to be involved in God's business, you're going to be wrong a lot. Get used to it. Okay. Fourthly, you have the right to fail. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it has implications with the other. But Acts 13:13, when Paul and his party set sail from Paphos, they came to Perga in Pamphylia. And John Mark, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. Then Acts 15, the great division. You know, people say, I want to go back to a first century church. Oh, no, you don't. I mean, they were serial killers back then. And if you lied to the church about your tithe, man, they killed you off. God did. And Paul and Barnabas were not these wonderful, nice Christians, man. When Luke writes about them having this disagreement, it wasn't just a little, I disagree, but I disagree in love. It was like, I'm going to kill you. And the church had to separate them and send them off in different directions. The first century church had the same problems that we have. But you remember the issue in Acts 15 was over John Mark because he had messed up, missed his mother's cherry pie, got out of his sleeping bag, rolled it up, and went home. And then in 2 Timothy 4:11, only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me in ministry. If you've been in many of my classes, there are times when I say to you, you haven't lived long enough and you haven't sinned big enough to even have an opinion on that particular matter. There's a thing about when you come off to seminary, you know, you really are so sure about everything. And things have a tendency to be absolute one way or the other. And I'm glad for that. You know, I wouldn't have it any other way. But sometimes when it gets really rank, I want to say, you haven't sinned big enough and you haven't lived long enough to even have an opinion on that matter. In other words, you haven't blown it big time. My friend, Rusty Anderson, whom I quote a lot, friend of his called who had lost his family, who had found out he had a drinking problem. He had written 3 books and was pretty well known. He said, Rusty, I've lost my platform. Rusty said, no, you never had a platform. Now you've got a platform, and now they'll listen. That's so true. So true as leaders in the church. We do not give people the freedom to fail. We really don't. How many commencement speakers have you heard say, I walked out of one time, and he ought to be glad I only walked out. I wanted to stand up and say, you bozo, you're telling these people that failure is, or something like this, failure is only in the dictionary of fools and cowards. The kind of motivational stuff that you hear all the time, it's just not true. It's just not true. And so you have the freedom to fail. Harry Emerson Fosdick was the classical liberal of two or three generations ago. He was the guy at New York's Fifth Avenue Presbyterian, I think. Anyway, he was in the fundamentalist controversy. Today, the issues have gone so far that he'd probably be in our camp. He has a sermon called "Fundamentalist Sermon by a Liberal Preacher," which would just blow your socks off. A man of great, a very articulate spokesman for classical liberalism, not what we've come to see as liberalism today. But and a man that I'm convinced, though he was significantly wrong in some areas, a man I'm convinced was used in an amazing way by God. Harry Emerson Fosdick, when he was 27 years old, had a nervous breakdown. And if you want to know why God used him, don't look at his education. Don't look at his communication skills. Look at his nervous breakdown. And we are so afraid to fail. So, you know, one of the things I've really had to struggle with is, I've told you, this afternoon show may make it, it may not make it. Right now, this week, they're going to the OR Network in New York, and they're talking to Salem Network. I have over $250,000 in investment money in this thing from friends all over the country. You need to know that if I owe you $5, I'm going to come to your house before I go to sleep tonight and give you the $5 back. I can't sleep if I owe you $5. Well, you can imagine what $250,000 is doing to me. It's keeping me up. And so I was thinking, God, what about my integrity? What about my witness? By the way, all of them knew. They're all friends. And the ones I got it from were rich. They can still afford food and stuff. And they know it's a very risky venture and it may fail and that it's quite radical and it's out there and all that sort of stuff. And it was clearly stated in the documents of investment that it was a very risky venture. And so they all knew that. So it's not going to be a big deal. But I was praying in a hypocritical way to God the other day. And I was saying, you know, God, your witness is going to be hurt. Integrity that I've worked so hard to build. He said, oh, no, that's the only problem is. You're afraid you're going to make a fool of yourself, aren't you? You just hate to fail publicly, man. And that means you fail on all these radio stations and everybody knows it. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I don't care about the money, man. It's that I don't want to fail, and I don't want to fail publicly. And I said, Lord, couldn't I fail to one person? Why do I have to do it in front of all these people? I have this novel. And it's been wonderful for me, and it's been wonderful for God's people. I wrote this science fiction novel, and I got a contract from Crossways on it. Actually, I sent it to Jan Dennis at Crossways, and I didn't even... People will publish what I do because I travel so much. It's not because I'm a great writer, because I'm not, but because I travel so much, and then they can sell books, and so they figure... they'll publish drivel if they know they can sell books. They talk about ministry, but it ain't ministry, it's business. So I was afraid to send this novel to just anybody, but Jan I trusted, so I sent this novel to him. I said, would you read it? I have no desire to make a public fool of myself. Well, he wrote a letter back, said he'd stayed up all night reading, he really liked it, and sent a contract, which I thereupon signed. And I had these things about, you know, I'm going to be the great American novelist. It really is a wonderful story. Somebody knows how to write needs to write it sometime. But then he didn't publish it. But he had this contract. Well, I finally had to get a lawyer. The lawyer made me call him one more time. I'd written all these letters, no response. I said, just send it back to me, because by then I was convinced it was a great American work. And so finally, with the use of a lawyer, I got my contract back, and I sent it to Zondervan. And Zondervan sent me a letter, and I think I still have it, said, in effect, when you cut through all the sham and pretense, this work really stinks. And my editor, who really loves me, Steve Griffith, and represents me to book companies and edits my books, and he's got a ponytail, lives in the mountains of North Carolina, picked me up in a pickup truck. He wanted to get Richard Pratt to write for him. And I said, look, that's fine, but you better clean yourself up before you ask him, because he's not going to jump in your pickup truck the way I do. And he said, well, maybe Richard would. I don't know. But at any rate, at lunch, Steve, my beloved dear friend that I love more than a brother, held up my novel and said, the best thing he could say about it was, Steve, there's stuff worse than this published. Now that's not the point. The point is, when I got this contract from Crossways, I announced it to the world. My novel's going to be coming out in a year. And I announced it on my radio program. I announced it every place where... I was really proud of this. Everybody knows that I can put a sentence together that makes sense, but nobody knew I was an artist. And I went and tell people that I've done this novel, and I want you to get it. And not only that, I was using illustrations from the novel, just so I could tell people I was a novelist. Well, then, I'm faced with this thing that nobody's going to publish my novel, man. It's a big-time failure. And God, and I can hear him giggle every time he does it. I don't think I've been in any place where I've been in studio doing a talk show when some twit didn't call me up and say, hey, Steve, why haven't that novel? And then I say, Lord, don't do this to me again, man. I told this story 1,000 times. Then I have to go through everything I just told you. And then I'll think, I've learned my lesson. You don't have to do that anymore. And I go to some other place. Somebody say, hey, Steve, I've been looking for that novel. I haven't seen it before. What happened to it? Then I got to say, but you know, I have the right to fail. I really do. And you do too. And let me tell you, what I just told you didn't make you think less of me. I mean, it really didn't. I can see it in your eyes. And if you tell me about your failure, I'm not going to think any less of you. I'm going to think you're a human being and that it's all right. Yeah.
With the exception of the Apostle Paul and Martin Luther, can you think of anybody else in church history who is like open with their failure in their public ministry?
Yeah, a lot. Barclay was. Spurgeon was bipolar. Was very clear about the depression he went through. Morning and Evening was not written from a pedestal of having it together. It was written from a man who was dying. No question. Everybody thinks of Jonathan Edwards in terms of sinners in the hands of an angry God, but extremely human, extremely open about his own failure. He was kicked out of his church.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.